If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. As recent history has shown us, human societies can prove surprisingly frail in the face of a tiny yet powerful force, the microbes that cause infectious diseases. In his new book, Pathogenesis, Jonathan Kennedy charts some of the ways in which germs and the contagions that they cause have altered the course of history. Matt Elton caught up with him to find out more.
This is obviously something that you research and you teach. How did that feel, having this subject suddenly thrust into the spotlight over the past 3-4 years or so?
It's been a really fascinating few years for me, although like everyone else, somewhat disturbing to see the progress of the pandemic. And my background is in history, but for the last 6-7 years, I've taught public health in a medical school, and I've spent quite a lot of time looking at vaccine hesitancy. So when the pandemic arrived, I was really, really quite interested to see how things would evolve. But I think in a way, this book is to some extent my therapy, because for the first few months, it was really quite stressful watching the news and reading the newspaper and, you know, having so much information about something that you're so interested in. So after a couple of months, I decided to take a step back and write this history of the world and this history of how infectious diseases have impacted the world over the last kind of 60,000 years.
The ways in which human history and disease intersect is obviously a major theme of this book. To rewind right to the very start, is there a point in human history at which this relationship first became significant, or that we can trace to being the very first step in this process?
Well, I think, you know, we have to first appreciate that we've evolved in a world that's been dominated by bacteria and viruses. So they've always been there, and they've always had an impact on us in good and bad ways, as we'll probably talk about in a little while. But I think the period at which infectious diseases emerged in a way that we're kind of aware of them at the moment is the so-called Neolithic Revolution. So about 12,000 years ago, people in the Middle East, in the Fertile Crescent, began to experiment with farming. So they began to cultivate crops and to rear animals. And perhaps 3,000 years later, the vast majority of people in the region got the vast majority of their calories from settled farming. And this was an absolute revolution in the way that humans had lived. For the past 200,000 years or so, we'd lived as hunter-gatherers. And then all of a sudden, we settle down and start farming. And you see various other processes similar to this around the world a little bit after what was occurring in the Fertile Crescent. But this meant that for the first time, lots and lots of humans were living in densely populated and insanitary settlements, very close to animals. And so this created the opportunity for many infectious diseases to hop from animals to humans. And it also created the conditions for these pathogens to transmit from one person to another, either through the air or through water that was infected. And also the fact that people started trading created the opportunity for diseases to travel long distances, so for epidemics and pandemics to occur. And there's been a lot of really interesting research in genetics that has showed that many of the diseases that have plagued, if you excuse the pun, humans for the last few thousand years emerged in the wake of the adoption of farming. So diseases like Yersinia pestis, that's plague, polio, smallpox, measles, which have had a absolutely devastating impact on humans emerged around this time. And yeah, certainly it's interesting in the context of COVID, because I think, you know, within the first few weeks of COVID arriving, it became a cliche to say that it was unprecedented, it was extraordinary. But actually, when you look at the long durée, when you look at history over the long term, you see that it's anything but unprecedented, that time and again, you have these devastating pandemics that come along and they kill millions of people. At various points in history, they bring down whole civilizations, but it's not all bad news. At times, they create the space, new ideas and new societies to emerge. And so in that way, they've been one of the great motors of history, and they're behind some of the really big transformations in history.
One of the recurring themes in your book is the fact that they've shaped history to such a great extent, and we haven't always acknowledged them as a factor in the shape of human history. Do you think that's something about the fact that they are so small or so unseen, or do you think it's more about the fact they're outside of our control, or all of those things?
So even if we go back to the Old Testament, the Bible, and we look at Genesis, it's very, very anthropocentric. God creates man and woman in his own image, and he supposedly grants us dominion over the land, the sea, and the animals. So the natural world is just a stage on which humans are the protagonists. And if you look at a lot of history, it's really kind of carried on this perspective, this way of looking at the world, whether it's the kind of old school great man of history theories, or if it's kind of more left-wing studies of history that really focus on large numbers of people, so on classes, the natural world is still very much seen as a stage on which these individuals and these groups play out their roles. And, you know, I think it's becoming increasingly evident that, you know, the world, or the natural world at least, isn't a stage. It's better to conceptualize it as an ecosystem, and we're just one small part of that ecosystem, and we play a big role in the world, but we're certainly massively influenced by other factors, including microbes, but also things like climate change. So it's only relatively recently that humans have actually really understood the role that microbes play in the world. This kind of world of microbes that's on the one hand so tiny that we can't see it, but on the other hand so vast that the numbers are just mind-blowing, was first discovered by a Dutch haberdasher in the late 17th century, a man called Antony van Leeuwenhoek, if Dutch people can forgive my pronunciation. And he obviously sold textiles, but he also had a little bit of a penchant for grinding lenses. And I believe this was because he wanted to inspect the cloth that he was buying and selling. But then he also began to start looking at various things with these lenses. And he looked at water, and he looked at the plaque in teeth. He saw this new world that was absolutely teeming with microscopic life. He called the things that he saw animalcules. And some of these were bacteria, and some of these were other microbes, things like protozoa. This is probably the closest that any human has got to kind of falling down the rabbit hole and finding themselves in a world of fantastical creatures. And, you know, one can still read the letters that he wrote to the Royal Society in London, just expressing how astonished he was and how enraptured he was with what he had seen. But he didn't really understand the role that these animalcules, these microbes, played in the world. It wasn't until 200 years later, so towards the end of the 19th century, that people like Louis Pasteur started to understand that these little microbes played a massive role in the functioning of our planets and even our bodies. Yeah, so Pasteur was the first person to realize that infectious diseases weren't caused by imbalances of humors or black magic or unfortunate constellations of planets, that it was these tiny little animalcules, bacteria, we hadn't discovered viruses yet, that made people ill. And even so, it we're still discovering a lot about how these microbes impact our world and impact us. So there's been some really, really, really fascinating studies in the natural sciences over the last 10, 20 years that have really kind of emphasized the role that microbes play, not just in causing infectious diseases, but also in the really kind of healthy functioning of our planet and of our bodies and even our minds. So I think the study that really kind of startled me and also encouraged me to write this book was by some Belgian scientists, and they were looking at the bacteria that were in our stomachs. So I think we all know now about the microbiome, that there's something like 40 trillion bacteria in our bodies, so slightly more bacteria than there are human cells. And if we take this all together, it weighs something like 1 to 2 kilos, so the same as our brains. And these bacteria, many of them live in our stomach, and they don't make us sick. They actually have evolved with us, and they perform all sorts of really important processes in our body. And probably the main one is help us digesting food. So it's a symbiotic relationship. We provide the bacteria with a warm, relatively safe environment in our stomachs, with a hopefully constant supply of food and nutrients, and they help us to digest these nutrients in the way that we can process. But this study looked at the bacteria that was in the feces of about 2,000 Belgians, and it found that 90% of the strains they looked at were capable of producing neurotransmitters. So these are basically chemical messengers that can impact our brains. So things like serotonin and dopamine. And so this seems to suggest that these bacteria have evolved over millions of years to communicate with our bodies. And there's various theories as to why they would do this. But one theory is that if they're producing neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin that make us happy and make us want to socialize, this creates opportunities for the bacteria to spread from one body to another. So it kind of helps it colonize other bodies. And I remember reading this and just being absolutely kind of astonished. It's astonishing in several ways. One, the impact that it might have on medicine. So the fact that in the future we might not treat depression with Prozac or with therapy, you might be kind of prescribed a fecal transplant by the doctor. But also it got me thinking about, you know, what does it mean to be human? If these tiny bacteria that we can't see, that we don't really kind of appreciate are there, have such a big influence on us as individuals, even on the way that we think, what impact do they have on aggregations of bodies? So the body politic, the body economic, the body social, what influence do they have on history? And I guess that was also a starting point for thinking about this book.
It's extraordinary when you talk about them like that. Just the extent to which they can have an influence on the course of an individual life. So when we scale up to the course of an entire civilization, what does that tell us? Say, for instance, we were to head back to the ancient world. What impact did these tiny microbes have on ancient civilizations at a civilization level?
Well, in short, a really profound influence. If we look at one of the first historical tracts, Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, which is obviously about the conflict in the 5th century BC between Athens on the one hand and Sparta on the other. He provides the first account of a outbreak of infectious disease, and he talks about its influence on the whole kind of outcome of the war. And I think this is really, really important, the fact that, you know, if we say it's the second historical account after Herodotus's histories, the second account in history has a really detailed description of infectious diseases and its impact on Athens. It shows us how vital pandemics and epidemics have been in history. So, you know, if we go back to ancient Athens in the middle of the 5th century BC, it came kind of crashing down with the start of the Peloponnesian War with Sparta. And Sparta was a really different type of policy. It was militaristic, it was oligarchic, and it was about as different to Athens as you could imagine, really. And so when the Spartan army invaded Attica, the rural inhabitants retreated behind the great city walls of Athens, and this created the kind of perfect conditions for an epidemic to occur. So Thucydides suggests that it came via a ship from Alexandria, and it spread quickly throughout the population and killed maybe a third of the people, including lots of the soldiers and also Pericles. And Thucydides writes about how this really has a big impact on the war. Even though the war went on for another 25 years, Athens was weakened, and it wasn't just weakened for a few years. It was weakened for, you know, generations because of the loss of people. And also, you know, with Pericles, the Athenians lost a really great statesman and a great general who devised this defensive plan, which made really perfect sense from a military perspective, but was a disaster from a public health perspective. And after this, he was replaced by all sorts of less able leaders who undertook a variety of pretty disastrous campaigns, including the decision to invade Sicily. So this is the first point in history that we see an epidemic really kind of change the trajectory of history. And, you know, this is just the first of many, many examples, but it's kind of really important. If we think of ancient Athens as the first iteration of Western civilization, and it was brought crashing down by an outbreak of infectious disease, possibly smallpox, people think. But then, you know, we move on to ancient Rome, and Kyle Harper has written a great book about this, called The Fate of Rome, which really brings infectious diseases back into the story of Rome. He basically describes how the success of Rome in the first century of the first millennium really created the conditions for infectious diseases to arrive and to spread. So, you know, Rome was a vast, vast empire at this point in time. It stretched all the way from Hadrian's Wall to the Arabian Peninsula in the east. You know, Rome was a massive city at this time. It was a city of over a million people. And that size of city wasn't reached again until London in the 1800s. So it's really, really remarkable. Also, the Romans, they had trade links with, you know, much of the so-called old world. So they'd obviously trade with sub-Saharan Africa. We know this because of all the animals that were being used in the Colosseum. We also know that they were trading with India. There was an Indian town that was big enough to have a temple that was dedicated to one of the Roman gods. But also, we know from the Chinese imperial records that the Romans first arrived in the middle of the second century Common Era. And so this really created the conditions that were ideal for new pathogens to arrive from somewhere else, and then once they arrived, to spread quickly through the big towns, but also through this kind of well-connected, densely populated empire. And first of all, the Antonine Plague brought the Pax Romana to an end, and then you have a series of other pandemics over the next 500 years that really have a crucial impact on the history of ancient Rome.
Something that strikes me about this is this is such sweeping epic history. Do we get a sense of a human's place in this story by taking such a top level sort of macro view of it?
I suppose we really have to be careful not to be nihilistic. We can look at the science and we can look at the history and we can show that infectious diseases have played a really, really enormous role. But this doesn't mean that humans can't make a difference. This doesn't mean that we should just give up and let microbes do their things. To kind of misquote Marx, I guess, humans can still make their own history, but it's not in circumstances of their own choosing necessarily. It's in circumstances created in part by infectious disease outbreaks, but also by other other phenomenon related to the natural world. So climate change and things like that. And, you know, we certainly know that humans aren't blameless in the emergence of pandemics or in climate change. So that also means that we can mitigate the impact of these changes that occur in the natural world.
Can we talk about the ways in which, I suppose, the colonization of the Americas was, the outcome of that was shaped by the presence of disease?
Yeah, definitely. So I think, you know, most people's view of the colonization of Americas probably fits in pretty well with the title of Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs and Steel. So germs were part of the story, but also Europeans and the Spanish in particular had better weapons and were so much more technologically advanced that it would have been inevitable anyway that the Europeans would have colonized the Americas. But I think, you know, you can compare this to some modern day historical events, and you can see how absurd it is that, you know, if we think about the conquest of the Mexica or the Aztecs in the 1520s, the fact that Hernan Cortes went to Mesoamerica with 1,000 troops and he managed to conquer this vast empire that ranged from the Atlantic to the Pacific, where the capital city had several hundred thousand inhabitants, was four times bigger than the biggest city in Spain. And within a couple of years, the Spanish had managed to conquer the whole of Mesoamerica. Or even more absurd is Pizarro 10 years later, when he went to South America and conquered the great Inca Empire with 168 soldiers. You know, it's kind of, this can't be understood unless you understand the really phenomenal role that infectious diseases played. And this was a secret weapon. So the conquistadors brought these diseases from the old world that the population of the Americas had no immunity to. And this just devastated them. Best estimates suggest that the population of the Americas fell from something like 60 million when Columbus arrived to 6 million 100 years later. And this fall in population is pretty much unprecedented in history. It's possible to look at the ice cores that have been drilled in Greenland and see the impact of this on levels of carbon dioxide in the air. Meteorologists suggest that it would have led to a decrease in the world's temperature and that it contributed to the little ice age that was occurring in Europe in the 1600s. And it's ethnocentric nonsense, basically, to think that Europeans could have conquered the Americas without the impact of these diseases. And I think we can see that very clearly when we compare the Americas to Africa and the colonization of Africa. In some respects, there are some similarities. So Europeans really coveted the natural resources in West Africa. In the Middle Ages, it was the main source of gold in Europe. And, you know, we might think about West Africa now as being a very poor region, but in the Middle Ages, it was seen as a source of vast wealth. And this was in part informed by the stories of Mansa Musa, the Malian emperor, traveling to Arabia on pilgrimage in the 13th century. And supposedly he took tons and tons of pure gold with him, and he handed it out with such abandon on his way that it led to or it depressed the price of gold for decades in the Eastern Mediterranean region. And we can see this by looking at maps of the Middle Ages too. Africa is a region that's presented as being very, very wealthy. So, you know, Europeans wanted to conquer Africa. They just couldn't. And, you know, part of this was because, you know, there were strong and sophisticated civilizations, polities there that made it difficult. But also we have to look at the role of infectious diseases. The Europeans didn't benefit from the secret weapon of smallpox, measles, and other diseases because Africa was still part of the old world. There were still trade links. So Africans would have, on the whole, have developed some kind of immunity. but we also see a kind of different role for infectious diseases. So West Africa was a place with perfect conditions for falciparum malaria, the most deadly form of malaria. Even today in West Africa, it kills hundreds of thousands of young children. But if you're lucky enough to survive, if you're repeatedly exposed to malaria, then after a while, you develop some kind of resistance. So, you know, you don't show such extreme symptoms. But for the European adults who were arriving in Africa for the first time and being exposed to malaria, it was just, you know, really, really deadly. So even in the 18th, 19th century, historians have estimated that something like 50 to 70% of would-be settlers were killed by infectious diseases, mainly malaria, in the first year in which they lived in West Africa. And in fact, in the early 19th century, people talked about West Africa being a white man's grave because it killed so many would-be European settlers. You can really see the impact of this because even if you look at the African continent in 1870, it's hardly been colonized by the Europeans at all. At this point, South America has been controlled by the Spanish and their descendants for centuries, but about 10% of the African landmass is under European control. And this is only in the kind of temperate regions in the very south, the South African provinces, and then in the north, with Algeria being controlled by the French. The vast majority of the African continent is impenetrable to Europeans until the widespread use of quinine, and then it becomes kind of bearable. But I think this comparison between, on the one hand, the Americas and the African continent really kind of illustrates the role that infectious diseases played in history. The fact that, on the one hand, in the Americas, diseases like smallpox were unwittingly, but still a very important secret weapon that was carried by the Europeans. And if we look at the attempt to settle in Africa, you see that diseases like malaria, but also we could talk about yellow fever, really create this defensive force field that make the continent more or less impenetrable.
We should talk about slavery as part of this story. You write that the emergence of American slavery and the ideology of racism used to justify it had a great deal to do with infectious disease. Can you talk us through this story?
The main point to realise is that although, you know, slavery has been a phenomenon throughout history, and if we go back to the so-called Neolithic Revolution, we can see the enslavement of humans as an extension of the domestication of animals, right? It's this process of dehumanizing humans and treating them as beasts of burden. But what really surprised me when I was researching this book was the fact that up until about 1500, there was no association between the color of one's skin and one's kind of capability for servitude, for slavery. And this seems to come about as a result of a variety of contingent factors, including the role of infectious diseases like malaria and yellow fever. So one of the interesting quirks of history is the fact that Christopher Columbus arrived in the Americas in 1492, the very same year that the Spanish monarchs Isabel and Fernando defeated the Emirate of Granada and finally reconquered the Iberian Peninsula. And of course, these two are connected, but I think the important thing to remember here is that up until the completion of the Reconquista, the main source of slave labor in Spain would have been from captured Muslims. And obviously, after 1492, this source of slave labor is no longer available. Southern Europeans might also have looked to the Black Sea slave markets, and this was another major source of slave labor. The capturing of peoples that were living to the north of the Black Sea, and of course, Genovese merchants played a big role in this. And you know, we shouldn't forget that Columbus was a Genovese sailor, but with the expansion of the Ottomans in the Eastern Mediterranean, this source of slave labor was also drying up, and so the Spanish had to look elsewhere for people to work. And so this created a big problem for the Spanish, who at the time were colonizing the tropical parts of the Americas, because they wanted to set up plantations. They found in the Caribbean soil and a climate that was perfect for growing sugar, which was in massive demand back home. But infectious diseases had killed the local population. And as we were talking about, the regular sources of slave labor had dried up. So what they did was they turned to the slave markets of West Africa, and they began to bring these very unfortunate Africans across the Atlantic to work on their sugar plantations. And this basically set up a path dependency that made it impossible for other colonizing nations to choose other ways of organizing their colonies. So I think Barbados is a really interesting example in this respect. So the British colonized Barbados in the 1620s. They wanted to set up a sugar plantation to, again, cash in on the demand for sugar back home. But there was no recent history of slavery in the British Isles. So what they did was the British decided they would adapt the kind of traditional system of apprenticeship to the new world. And basically they devised this system of indentured labor where people would basically get a free ticket across the Atlantic. They would have basically food and accommodation for a number of years, 3, 5, 7 years. And when they had completed this period, they were free to go and make a new life in the new world. And so this made perfect sense. And even Adam Smith talks about this in the Wealth of Nations. You know, he objects to slavery from a moral perspective, but he also says that it makes perfect economic sense to employ free laborers rather than slave laborers, because the cost of controlling your enslaved laborers is so great. And because these slave laborers have very little incentive to work hard and many reasons to try and escape, many reasons to cause chaos, it's just it didn't make any sense to him. The thing that Smith didn't realize, and the problem that the Barbadian landowners had, was that when the Spanish had brought Africans over the Atlantic to work as slave laborers, they'd also brought yellow fever and malaria. And so in the middle of the 16th century, there was a massive yellow fever outbreak in Barbados. It killed half of the population. So the plantation owners realized that enslaved laborers from West Africa had developed resistance and immunity to yellow fever and malaria, whereas the European indentured laborers happened. And so this basically, after a while, meant that throughout the whole of the Caribbean, throughout the whole of the tropical region of Africa, all plantation owners chose this way of organizing their plantations, where they employed slave labor in horrific conditions. So, you know, I think it's really interesting to see how infectious diseases brought out the worst in humans in this case. And, you know, the impact of this is absolutely catastrophic, right? If we think something like 12 million people were shipped across the Atlantic from West Africa, 2 million died on the journey. Those that arrived were sold into slavery and had to live in really, really terrible conditions.
Do you think that our response to COVID-19 was in any meaningful way shaped by this history? Or were there, I suppose, lessons from the past that we should have taken on board but didn't?
I think what's really striking is that the initial public health response, so before effective vaccines were developed, and remember that took a whole year, were incredibly similar to the public health response that was used in the Middle Ages and the early modern period. So the basic point of the public health response was to restrict the movement of people and to reduce the opportunities for basically the virus to jump from one person to another. And, you know, this is very, very similar to, I guess, the quarantines and the cordon sanitaire of the past. It's just the modern iteration of that. So, you know, of course, quarantine comes from the Italian for 40, quaranta. And this is because the Italian city-states, basically towards the end of the 14th century, started to force ships that were coming into their ports to quarantine, to isolate for a period of time before they could enter the city. And over time, this got regularized as 40 days. And this has no scientific significance. This was based on the Bible. So 40 days was the amount of time that the floods lasted in Genesis, and the amount of time that Jesus went to the wilderness. But it was long enough for the plague to basically burn out on a ship if it was infected. And so this became kind of very common throughout Europe. And then you also had these kind of quite remarkable cordon sanitaires. And I think the most interesting example comes from the Habsburg Empire. And they had a kind of 1,500-kilometer military border with the Ottoman Empire in I guess, kind of south and eastern Europe. And this was seen as a big source of the plague. And between 1710 and 1871, they basically kind of had a massive cordon sanitaire. And if you wanted to pass from the Ottoman Empire into the Habsburg Empire, you had to go to these quarantine centers and stay there for 48 days. And if you tried to cheat the system, you were likely to be tried by a military court, and the worst punishment you could have was being killed. So yeah, it's on the one hand, it's really interesting to see how, you know, we haven't moved on that far. But I think also, you know, we have to acknowledge the massive role that medical advances have played in the last 100 years or so, and particularly played in the COVID pandemic. So basically we see, you know, this development of vaccines in a miraculously short time that turned the virus from what seemed like an existential threat at some point into a vaccine preventable disease, more or less. You know, when you look at the history of infectious diseases, and when you think of the fact that we're living on this planet and we're surrounded by viruses and bacterias, which are everywhere and are mutating all the time, sometimes in ways that can harm us, it can seem, you know, pretty scary. We can feel pretty vulnerable. But I think, you know, we shouldn't be hubristic, but the developments in medical science in the last few years have really been phenomenal, and I think they can give us hope as a species that we can survive.
That was Jonathan Kennedy. Pathogenesis: How Germs Made History is out now, published by Tauber. And if you're intrigued to find out more about how humanity's progress has been accompanied by a revolving door of parasites, bacteria, and viruses, then be sure to check out our previous podcast episode with Kyle Harper, who explored how microbes have wreaked havoc on our health. Just search for Plagues of Our Past wherever you get your podcasts to bring that up. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.